Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 33rd episode of the Next Stage Press podcast, where we talk theater and playwriting with the various artists of Next Stage Press. I'm your host, Gene Cato. Today's guest is a man of many talents. At any given moment, you can find him teaching college theater courses, running administration in a theater department he brought back from the brink of shuttering, swinging swords and throwing punches with students, and writing some of the funniest farces you'll read. I'm talking about Texas playwright and fight director H. Russ Brown. Over the course of our conversation, H. and I discussed such topics as how his love of comedy has propelled him forward as he builds his plays and his theater department, how his training as a fight director has given his students valuable training that you just don't find in every theater program, and how his determination to write plays with roles that are non-gender specific could catapult his future works to the top of the list for theater companies that would otherwise be hampered by gender demographics. It was an insightful conversation with one of the true Renaissance men of the Lone Star State. So, let's go to that conversation. Well, good morning, H. Boy, it's almost afternoon for you right there. I appreciate you jumping on here and having an opportunity to talk with you on the Next Stage Press podcast. Gosh, I can't believe this seems to be my month of having people that have been playwrights for a while. And, you know, the Next Stage Press podcast was gone for a little while, so there was a chunk of time that stuff wasn't happening. So now we're catching up on everybody that's been part of the Next Stage Press family for a while. But I am so thrilled to have you on the podcast at this point, because there are some awesome things that are going on down in your neck of the woods. You got a crazy and wild show that is opening this week that we will talk about later on that has the most unusual title that I have ever heard in a play. And, and you've got some interesting history that we've got with all this that I'd like to take some time with you about. So thank you for joining us on the podcast.
It is my great honor to be here.
Yeah. I want to start off, we'll get this out of the way because this is kind of my standard start, just so that, I know you travel a lot and, we're going to get to your fight choreography stuff here in a little while, but, a lot of people know you. Again, we're going to open it up for people, that haven't run into you yet. We'll use the word yet. I always like saying that. Tell everyone a little bit about how you began your theatrical journey towards playwriting. I always like to hear the origin story for our writers like that. How did you get into it, and how did theater start with you, and how did it get you to where you are today?
Well, loaded question to be sure. I've always enjoyed writing a great deal. I did a lot of creative writing in high school and junior high. As a kid, and I would write my own little stories, and I started out writing comic book stories. I'm a big comic book fan, and I would write out my own characters and arcs, and I would interweave my characters into universes and things like that. So I would write storylines that I wanted to see in comic books, and then as time went on and I eventually found my way into theater, I was acting and doing fight direction and things like that. But my wife is a theater director as well. And at the time she was working a lot with youth programs, directing short plays for students and elementary and junior high and high school age. And she was just looking for short, fun plays that would be engaging for the students and the audience. And she wasn't finding a lot of stuff out there. And she goes, "You're a writer. Why don't you write me a little play for this thing?" And so it kind of started that way. She'd just say, how many kids do you have?" "Well, I've got 9 kids. And what if we did something like this?" "Great, let's write it." And so I was writing like 10-minute plays, 15, 20, 30-minute plays, mostly kid-based stuff, you know, things like How the Elephant Got His Trunk. And then I wrote one about an old West town where the big showdown was between the beans or no beans and our chili people. And it even had a couple of songs in it that I wrote. So things like that. Children's plays is how I got going. And then I love comedy, and I've always loved writing comedy. And so all the plays that I wrote for her theater kids were comedic in nature, just because I love that stuff. And it just kind of took off from there. And then I didn't sit down and write my first real serious play until I got to graduate school. And when I was in graduate school, I had an idea for a play, and it was a drama at the time. I tried my hand at a drama. It was about a guy who found out on the day of his retirement that the retirement funds had been drained by somebody in the company, and all his big hopes and dreams came crashing down. And it was a little short one act, and it was okay, but it was enough that I'd gotten a response from the people in my department who'd read it, that they were like, keep doing this, keep writing. And then I thought, well, I just need to lean into what I know best, which is comedy. Cause as an actor, as a performer, that's where and as a director, that's where my wheelhouse truly lived, on what worked comedically. And so my first stab at writing a legit play was a one act version of what eventually became Stud Ducks and Horny Toads, which is a semi autobiographical but highly fictionalized account of parts of my upbringing, of me and the misadventures of me and my grandfather, who at the time was my best friend and partner in crime. And so that's kind of what got me started. And from there, I got some attention, and I received a one-act playwriting award from the Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival for that. And from that, a couple of the people suggested, they say, I see a full-length play here. And so I developed that into a full-length version. And then that also won awards, and eventually ended up winning a national fellowship award for me through the Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival. And it just kind of all took off from there. And then I just started writing.
All right. Well, it's interesting that you bring up the whole thing about, your love of comic books. People cannot see what I can see right now, but behind H on his wall, there is a big Captain America shield that is right there. And it looks like that there's on the screen behind you, there's pages of comics and stuff that are flashing. So that's pretty cool. Unbelievably cool. Now you are, you're the head of the theater department at the College of the Mainland, which, I, of course, know where it is, being a native Houstonian, but for the rest of the people listening to this, the College of the Mainland is a college that is situated between Houston and Galveston, and you have given that theater down there, your theater, the moniker of the biggest little theater in Texas. Talk a little bit about that. Tell us a little bit about the program, what the students, this is a perfect opportunity. We can use this as a recruiting tool. There you go. So, tell everybody a little bit about the program down there, what you focus on. And because I know from just looking at something, there are a few classes that you offer down there that a lot of theater classes, a lot of theater programs and stuff typically don't have. You work a lot. We're going to get to your fight choreography stuff, but having you as the head of the department, students get a little bit of dipping their toes into stage combat and fight choreography. And that is, not every program has that. So, talk a little bit about that and, what your program is like down there.
Absolutely. Yeah. College of the Mainland, it was founded in the late 60s. And just about the time they started, they built a theater here, and they started out with a theater model that was, they taught a few classes, and they would put on plays by the students, and then they would also pull in community members, and it sort of evolved into a combination community theater and academic theater program. And it went along that way for a while, and it slowly evolved into more just being thought of as just a community theater that involved both students and adults from outside the community. And it grew to have a pretty big reputation. In fact, where it actually got its nickname, the biggest little theater in Texas, was from Playboy magazine. They were doing a production here in its early stages of the best little whorehouse in Texas down here. And yep. One of the girls who was one of the featured performers in the show happened to be a Playboy bunny, a Playboy model at the time. So Playboy sent a reporter down here to do a whole article on the theater and the production of Whorehouse and all that. And along the way, that reporter gave it its eventual nom de plume, the biggest little theater in Texas. And so we've used that ever since. And it's true. We're just a postage stamp size stage, but we put on professional level quality productions that just blow people's minds. They can't believe that they're sitting at this little community college in the middle of nowhere and just having their faces blown off by all the awesome talent coming at them from the stage. And so
there's a question real quick before you get on to the next. How is it that I've known you for a couple of years? I'm from that area, and I had no idea that Playboy magazine had a hand in giving that theater its nickname.
Yeah, this was like in the 70s when it happened, or whenever it was in the early stages before Whorehouse really became a thing. So right. It was like a developmental process thing. But yeah, that was where it came from. Playboy magazine. I love telling people that story.
Wild.
Yeah. And I was in Chicago at the time working and adjuncting at several colleges about 10, 12 years ago and looking for my landing spot where I can make my mark. And ever since I've been married to my wife, she's from Clear Lake City, which is just up the road from here. Her first theater remembrances are of College of the Mainland. She and her family used to have season tickets. And so I've heard from her our entire marriage together. She would tell me about, I first saw this show at College of the Mainland, Comm Theater, blah, blah, blah. And so I'd heard about this place and I was job searching and I saw the ad pop up for somebody to come down and take over the program. And I said, honey, there's a position at College of the Mainland. And she said, apply, let's see what happens. And sure enough, I applied and got the gig. And when they brought me in, the program had gone through some changing of hands and things like that. And they'd gotten to where they were just really operating as community theater. They were doing mostly plays for older adults, and the academic side of the program had dwindled down to where they only had like three or four majors at the time. And in fact, when they brought me in, when I got hired and walked in the door, they said, we were on the verge of shutting this program down. We had two failed searches for your position. This was our third and final attempt. And basically, this program was either going to go away forever, or we're going to bring somebody in and give them a chance to try and turn it around. And I said, well, I'm the person that can do that. If you'll just, you know, give me the chance and you'll give me the tools that I need. And they said, well, what do you need? And I said, I just need a bag of swords. Buy me a bag of swords and I will build you a program. And so they bought me a bag of swords and I came in and I called all the local high schools within our district and a little bit beyond and said, hey, I'm H, I'm the new guy. And we here at Comm Theater, we are your free theater resource. Whatever you need, we will come in and do it. You need us to help you hang your lights or focus and program your light board? Gotcha. Need me to come in and teach dialects to your kids or do a swashbuckling workshop with swords or whatever you need? We'll come in, we'll do it for free. Just let us meet the kids, let us help. And so that bag of swords got me all around to all these schools. And here we are. We're about to end my ninth year here. And we've gone from a single major when I walked in the door to we're hovering around 60 majors now. And we get kids not just from our immediate district. We get kids from all over the state. I have kids who are, their hometown is 7-8 hours away from here. But they come here because now we've evolved into a destination training program, where kids know that they're going to come and get the most filled first 2 years of a theater training program than you can get anywhere else. More classes, more opportunities, and that's what we've built our reputation on, that and the quality of the training. So that's where we're at and what we're doing. We offer associate tracks in technical theater and performance track, and our kids, some of them just go out into the business after 2 years with us and we prepare them for that, or they transfer on and finish a bachelor's degree at the next level and we prepare them for that as well.
That's really impressive. I've been down to your theater I was at your theater last year with John Patrick Bray when his production of Donkey was going on. And the production values down at your place is unbelievable. The theater, your theater is a beautiful space. And you know, what's so beautiful about that story is the fact, you know, there's a, what did they always tell us years ago, that in order for theater to happen, the only thing that you need is a place to act and a place to watch. Those two things are the only thing really needed for theater to happen. And you started this entire, if you're down in the Houston area and you have not been to College of the Mainland to catch a show, you really should, because the product is fantastic. The theater is beautiful. And now if you take this story that H just told us, basically that, it all started, really coming back from the dead, basically all because of a bag of swords. It really makes that even that much more impressive. You know, I'm sitting here thinking, your very last play that you write in your life should be like George R. R. Martin. You should have that in the title of it should be a bag of swords. So that should be it. All right. Well, we're going to get to your plays here in just a few minutes, and I'm going to do something that I rarely do. I'm going to let you pick the order whenever we go through and see which ones that you want to talk about. But I'd like to know comedy actually even coming out of, it's your own words, is your forte. What playwrights, as you were developing, into your, your writing career and all that, what playwrights influenced you the most as you were, coming up through the theater ranks?
Well, the things that I like, the things that I appreciate and, about theater, I love being able to laugh at life. And it doesn't have to be straight on comedy. It could be a dramedy. It could be, have a lot of light moments and stuff, but I also love when comedy has heart, when things are rollicking along and then suddenly out of nowhere, it kind of sneaks up on you and pulls the old heartstrings or rips the old heart out, as the case may be. So I love that sort of element where, it just finds a couple of moments where it just gets really human on us. And so, people I love like that. I love Lanford Wilson is probably my favorite playwright.
Oh, yeah.
I love Lanford Wilson. Fifth of July is a wonderful example.
I was just thinking about Fifth of July, how great of a play that is.
If I could write a play like Fifth of July and have people go and be as, if I could have anyone be as affected by one of my plays as I was by Fifth of July, that would be the highest form of greatness for me. If I could ever hit somebody like that. But I love making people just laugh and then at some point make them go, oh gosh, why am I choking up right now? I've been laughing all night. Cause I think comedy can do that for us. I think it allows us to let our guard down a little bit and allow ourselves to be open to those really human moments. So when they happen, it's not a scary thing. It's just a communal thing.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So I really love him. And playwrights like him coming up. And one of my current favorite playwrights is Sean Grennan, who wrote The Tin Woman and A Rock Sails By. And he also is that sort of playwright. And I'll tell you who else, another recent person that I just really like. We just got through doing his production of Can't Live Without You is Philip Middleton Williams. I just really like his work. That play, I told him just the other day that what I appreciate about his characters is there's a lot of fun, there was a lot of heart, but he just made all his characters so effortlessly human, which I deeply appreciate as well.
Yeah, so, no doubt Phil's going to love that, because Philip Middleton Williams is one of the Next Stage Press playwrights, and I'll make sure and tag him on this so that he can hear that. I know that he was very appreciative of taking on the show and doing it, and talking to you, it sounded like it was just went off like gangbusters.
So well received.
It's good. All right. Well, we're going to turn back. Let's talk about you. So we're going to try to get all of these in here in our allotted time that we've got. Next Stage Press publishes four of your plays. So one of them is just coming out this next month. And it is, we're going to talk about that one last, but I want to talk about the other ones. There is, Calm Wasn't Built in a Day, Stud Ducks and Horny Toads, and A Divine Kerfuffle. Mm-hmm. Which one would you like to talk about first?
Let's go chronologically. Stud Ducks and Horny Toads. We kind of know the story about that one a little bit.
If you want, let me read the synopsis real quick so that everybody listening to it just says, this is for a cast of four men, two women, and one boy. Stud Ducks and Horny Toads follows the misadventures of Milton Day and his grandson Russell as they blaze a trail of bullshit across West Texas in this all-American comedy of warmth, wit, family, and taxidermied lizards. Now, real quick, before we get into this, this play has won a couple of awards, has it not?
Yeah, it's won a few. It's won a couple of Kennedy Center Awards at both the regional and national level.
Okay. All right. Take it away. Stud Ducks and Horny Toads.
Stud Ducks and Horny Toads, I said earlier, is kind of semi-autobiographical. Most of the main characters in the play are all based on actual people. Me, my grandmother, my grandfather, who was my best friend, and then my mom. Are all characters, but basically, my family is closely connected with the legend of Old Rip, which if you're not from Texas, you may not even know what this is all about, but you kind of do know, and you just don't know, you know. In the late 1800s, Eastland County in West Texas built a courthouse, and they had a cornerstone in which they put a time capsule. In that time capsule, they put a Bible and a boot, and they put some things that symbolize the time and era. And then a great-great uncle of mine, E.E. Woods, picked up a Texas horned toad lizard and put it in the time capsule. Then they sealed it up. And then the courthouse burnt down a few years later, and they had to rebuild it. And they opened up the time capsule, and when they did, they were taking all the things out, and they were dusting off everything. And then all of a sudden, that horned lizard that was in there, and this is 36 years after the fact, twitched. And then a few minutes later, it came back to life. It had gone into a hibernetic state, and it was in a coma for those however many 36 years. It came back to full life, lived for another 5 or 6 years, and it was on Ripley's Believe It or Not, and it met President Woodrow Wilson and all this other stuff. And in fact, he is, and this is why you might know about the legend. If you've ever seen Michigan J. Frog on the old Warner Brothers cartoon, "Hello, my baby. Hello, my darling."
Oh, yeah.
That is off of Old Rip. That's where they got the idea for that. But anyways, the whole story is that it's time to build a new case for Old Rip in the courthouse. And my grandfather, who built the original case, doesn't get the contract for the new case. And so he takes exception to it. My grandfather was a carpenter, and I would spend summers with him. So he and I go to the courthouse and kidnap Old Rip. And the mayor and the sheriff and my grandmother, who, you know, is highly tolerant, and my helicopter mother all get caught up in the chaos of it. But he's standing on his pride. It's a ton of fun and a lot of homespun stuff. And most of it, I'll be honest, it was so easy to write. My grandfather is probably one of the most quotable people on the planet. Almost everything he says in that play, he actually said at one point in time in his life.
Wow. Yeah, I always love those quotable lines. I know. What is it about grandparents that I'm wondering, as we go along, do we just get to a certain age that everything becomes a soundbite for us and we can just, they could just, everything they say, you could just quote.
Yeah, but that show's fun. It's just down home, and everybody would have somebody in there. In fact, the best compliment I ever got off that play is somebody walking out of it who didn't know at all said, "I felt like I just came from a family reunion," and laughed my butt off.
That's a great one. Well, Stud Ducks and Horny Toads, again, it's won a couple of awards. You can pick it up on the Next Stage Press website. If you're in New York City, drop by the Drama Bookshop. They have a couple of copies on the shelf. It is there. So make sure you drop by and get that one as well. All right. Let's move on to the next one. Let me take a guess. Calm Wasn't Built in a Day.
Calm Wasn't Built in a Day.
Okay. This has a little bit of a strange backstory to it here. Let me read the synopsis. Again, this is a little bit larger cast. This is eight men and three women. And it also won, looks like a Kennedy Center Award on that, and a down-home comedy very loosely based on actual people and events. It is fall of 1967 in the small town of Texas City, Texas. I wonder where that is. And Dr. Herbert F. Stallworth already has plenty to contend with in getting his new community college off the ground in their temporary quarters in an old dilapidated high school. But an open house night for local VIPs with no AC just before a vital bond election doesn't make it any easier. Throw in a greedy mayoral candidate, a wily local business owner, a very local student senate, a well-meaning custodian, and additional pressure from the powers that be, and you've got a hurricane of commotion. But with his trademark wit and affability, Dr. Stallworth navigates the rocky waters in this funny and affectionate mix of fact and fiction. The rest, as they say, is history. What say you, H. Russ Brett?
Yeah, this one was a project play that I didn't expect to write. College of the Mainland, when I first got here, they were gearing up for their big 50th anniversary. And so as part of the 50th anniversary, they were wanting to do all these things. They were going to have these historical remembrance days and things like that. And they were asking all the departments to chip in some kind of historical way. And one of the requests slash mandates that came down from on high was, well, why don't you do a play from the first season at College of the Mainland? And, you know, as a history thing, put one in the season. And I looked, and the stuff that they did back then, like the most approachable one was something called Hillbilly Jamboree or something like that. You know, so it was all a bunch of crazy, weird, archaic scripts and stuff and things I couldn't even find. A couple I couldn't even find. I didn't know where it came from. And I was like, there's not really anything that would be worth putting into our season. Maybe I'll just write a play. So I did a bunch of research. I hooked up with our local historian here at our college library, who actually was in the first graduating class from College of the Mainland. And she still works here. And she and I went through the archives and we talked about stuff, and she taught me so much about the college. And from that, I was loosely able to base a story off of what actually occurred. When they first built this college, they had to spend 2 years in the old high school from the segregation days. This was the black high school back in the day where all the African-American students went. And it had been because they'd segregated all the schools. Desegregated all the schools. This building had been sitting empty for a few years. So the first 2 years at College of the Mainland were in that building. Oh, wow. And there was a big contention over the land. We eventually built the college over, and there were some rumored shady dealings. And I took those bare facts and the actual president who built it up to what it is today and created this crazy farcical story about how it all resolved itself and worked out. And I even used a couple of real quotes from the actual President Stallworth. And the lady who was the historian, I made her one of the main characters in the play as one of the first students of the college. So it was a ton of fun. And it went off big. So people loved it.
Wow, but I can imagine. I can totally imagine. I you know what? And when I pulled up in front of your theater last year, I got out of my car and I looked and I said, wow, this wasn't built in a day.
Legit.
I know. All right, great. Well, we'll talk a little. That's so interesting that you're so it's like part. It's based on real event. It's not, obviously, you built up a lot of stuff in it for comedic effect. But yeah. All right. It's a very funny play. You should. Again, you can get that one on the Next Stage Press website for sure. Okay, we're going to move on to A Divine Kerfuffle. A Divine Kerfuffle was one of our most produced plays last year. And I've got a follow-up question later on, kind of concerning this. But this play was done all over the place. And it's just incredible. Let me read you a little bit about it. It's got a lot of swashbuckling sword fighting women in it and all. And there's just a lot to enjoy. The pictures and stuff that we saw of the original productions and the productions around the country and all that. It looks like everybody is just having a ball with this play. So we'll let you dive into exactly what made you get this one going. This is for a cast of 3 men, 3 women, and 6 men or women. The year is 1895, and Sarah Bernhardt is the greatest actress to ever grace the Victorian stage. Just ask her. The divine Sarah fears, however, her once bright star may be fading with all of the attention suddenly being lavished on a talented younger rival. When she stumbles across an incredible new script written by a naive but up-and-coming playwright, though, Sarah is convinced her path to theatrical immortality is assured until her rival also gets her hands on a copy. Throw in a fuss-budget theater manager, a stern Teutonic maid, a nimble-footed usher, plus a hilarious jumble of confusions and complications, and the stage is set for the ultimate showdown as the two dueling divas cross wits and blades in this frantically funny farce. All right. What made you come up with this one?
This one came out of an idea or a suggestion from a friend of mine. I'm a certified teacher and fight director with the Society of American Fight Directors, and I used to coordinate the National Stage Combat Workshop. And a fellow certified teacher and fight director friend of mine, name of Angela Bonacasa, she's also highly skilled and very talented swashbuckler herself. And so we love that swashbuckling style. And so one day between classes, she and I were just playing around with swords and making up fight stuff. And as we were doing so, she made a comment about, I wish there were more swashbuckling roles for women. And I thought, well, heck, I'm a playwright. I can do something about that. And at the time, I got inspired pretty quickly. And I went home, and I had just recently, in a couple of years prior to that, had done a big paper on Sarah Bernhardt, the Victorian star of stage. She was like considered the first true superstar of acting of the theater world, or what we would consider a superstar these days. And then she had a sort of mostly fictionalized rivalry between another actress of the day named Eleanor Doucet. And they had a little bit of a rivalry, but it was mostly for effect. They actually were good friends, but they would caterwaul at each other back and forth about, you know, this and that to gain publicity for each other's shows. They found that if they fought, people would go see the shows to try and cross compare them and all that. And so there was an actual historical period where they were both playing the same role in the same play at the same time in London in two theaters that were across the street from each other. And so that was actual fact. So I just kind of took that and made a fictional thing and created the first two scenes of this play with the idea of being, you know, oh, this would be great. They could cross blades because Sarah Bernhardt was known for playing like Peter Pan and Hamlet and pants roles where sword fighting was involved. And so, but I got that first couple of scenes done and then life kind of took over and it kind of gathered dust for a few years. And I have my big idea playbook. I've got all these pages of little scraps of scenes or little ideas or concepts and stuff. And then the pandemic rolled around and I suddenly had not much to do. And I thought, well, let's sit down and do a little writing. And then I went through and I flipped through and I found those first two scenes from that play. And I was like, oh, this is perfect. Why don't I write this? Because I knew I had some students at the time that if I finished it, they could really pull those roles off. And so I finished the play and we produced it and it came off brilliantly. We ended up winning several awards from the Kennedy Center at both the regional and national level for that one, for the kids themselves and for the play itself and the overall production. So it was just phenomenally successful and it's been just a ton of fun to work on. But yeah, it came out of the need. I was just trying to create more work for my fight friends as fight directors and actresses who so often are outstanding sword fighters. Some of the best swashbucklers I know are women. They get the aesthetic better than most guys.
Wow. Wow. That's fantastic. I want to ask you a little bit about this because there is, this will kind of segue a little bit into the next question, because again, yeah, we talked about you becoming an acclaimed fight director. And in the last year or so, it seems like that shows with, women with swords and to some degree in the last couple of years, just women fighting in general seems like that the ladies are stepping up to where there's all of these shows that have got these huge amounts of stage combat. I know, for instance, you was it the last season you guys did the Sweet Science of Bruising, which has had a lot of productions all over. So you've got the women boxing in that. We have a Divine Kerfuffle. Arthur M. Jolly has a play, The Lady Demands Satisfaction, which has also sword fighting women at that point. Why do you think that is becoming more popular as of late? And also talk a little bit about what a good fight choreographer can bring to the table in those shows.
I think the reason it's happening is because people are finally writing the works producing the works and casting in ways that allow it to happen. I mean, there's always been, all along the way since Sarah Bernhardt's time, there's been women and people perfectly capable of doing these sorts of things, but it's just always been in the mindset of, oh, this is, you know, swashbucklers, the dashing male saves the waifish, you know, ingenue. But women can save themselves. So
yeah, for sure.
Let's create works where that can happen, you know, and if, you know, me being a middle-aged white guy, if I can create a piece though that will open that door for some young actresses, or in this case, it can be actresses of a certain age who are capable of pulling off these kinds of roles, then I will do that.
It seems so exciting that these plays and stuff are all, you know, that, you know, I, again, it's like what you're talking about. Of course the ability has been there. Of course we know that, but I mean, it's just all of a sudden it's like playwrights are making the choice now to actively create these characters, and not only from, what they bring to the table, obviously for an actor in a season, but just, I mean, the use of them also in, educational theater. Or all of a sudden bringing in other disciplines so that by the time that the students leave these different, theater programs now, then they've come out of there with, skill sets that they may not have had in decades past.
Yeah. I mean, there's along the way, there's been other outlets and ways in which that has helped things grow. Like there's a theater troupe called Babes with Blades in Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
They're phenomenal, and they put on plays where it is by women for women, featuring women who are badasses with swords and guns and knives and fists and whatever else you need. And there's some of that also that spills over into like the Ren Fair circuits, Renaissance fairs. There's a out on the East Coast, particularly. There's a whole group of lady swashbucklers called Vixens on Guard, who are phenomenal artists and athletes and performers. I mean, it's out there. There's a market for it. You just have to find theaters that are willing to do it, because the audience will come.
Well, and Babes with Blades, I'll circle back to that, because we are fortunate enough at Next Stage Press to have a couple of copies. We have a couple of copies of plays. We have a couple of scripts that actually started with Babes with Blades. Arthur M. Jolly actually is, you know, he's had a couple of them. A Gulag Mouse, which was
great.
It's an absolutely fantastic show. And they made a movie out of it, actually. And then there is Trash, which is a two-person show where it's two sisters in a trash heap, and they just beat the hell out of one another by the time that the show – I mean, it is like an hour and a half of these two sisters just fighting it out, looking for something in a trash heap. So that's interesting. The fight choreographers – you know, the next play that we have that's coming out, Hui Haas and Fu Feralls, you actually make there's a paragraph at the very beginning whenever, you know, in the playwright's notes where you're talking about do yourself a favor and get a qualified fight choreographer to work with you when you're doing this show. Talk about what a good fight choreographer brings to the table.
Yeah, all my plays that I do, they're all comedy and they all have violence of some sort in them, because to me that's funny. But I in the playwright's notes I say in all of them that get yourself a qualified fight director. And if you don't know one, seek one out. And then I put the website for the Society of American Fight Directors, WWSAFD.org, because it does bring so much to the table. You want to make sure that what you're putting on stage, first of all, foremost, the reason we exist is because we want to tell good stories, but we want our actors to be safe. We want it to be repeatable 8 shows a week. You know, you can't have Hamlet one night only and make that a sustainable thing. So you want it to be safe so the actors feel secure and no one is losing jobs over this kind of thing or being sued over this kind of thing. But you also want it to serve the story because nothing's worse than having some awesome drama or comedy or something and you're invested in it and you're into it so good and the story's just flowing along and all of a sudden we get to the fight scene. And then if it's poorly done, it can go poorly two ways. It can be dangerous. It can look reckless. And sometimes audiences can recognize when something that is just dangerous. And then suddenly they're concerned for the actors. They're no longer thinking about the play. They're worrying about the actors who could probably get hurt in this moment. Or it could go the other way and we could build to this amazing moment and the tension is so high and now we must fight or sing and dance, but we must fight. And then it's lame, Weenie Hut Jr. And it's just, you know, it doesn't meet the same level that we've been feeding up to at that point. And so either way, you're pulling your audience out of the story and you're wasting their money and doing them a huge disservice. So a fight director, a good fight director, can help serve the story and keep that exciting and dynamic for the audience without unsettling them and pulling them out of the moment. You know, that's the skill of one. We know what to look for. We know how to tell a good story and we know how to keep everybody safe. We find the balance and all it will do is elevate your story. Any other thing will just lessen the event. I mean, you don't want that.
For sure. For sure. All right. We've got I don't know, probably about 10 minutes left here. I want to make sure that we get to this last one. I am going to butcher the name of this town. So I'm going to ask you first, is it Batu Haven?
Batu Haven.
Batu Haven. That's what I thought. Okay. Oh, see there. I was going right. All right. We're going to talk about, okay, here we go. Wait for it, folks. Here is the title of the play that H has got. It's opening this week, correct?
Yep. Open tomorrow, April 18th.
Open tomorrow. So there you go. We're recording this right before opening night. Hui Haas and Fu Faraz, the complete button man's picket fence party planner. All right. Here is the synopsis. And you've done something very, the cast size on this. Normally I read the cast size first, but I'm going to read the synopsis and then I'm going to ask you about something with the cast here. The sleepy little burg of Batu Haven, Minnesota is an idyllic suburban gem of picket fences and manicured lawns until suddenly, with a literal bada bing boom, the sudden arrival of two mob enforcers causes what started as a simple cookout with the neighbors to quickly explode into a hilarious all-out rough and tumble tizzy of chaotic complications, esoteric entrees, and highbrow hoodlums on Palduva Lane. This cast, this, and I don't know that I've ever run into this before. This may be the first, this may be a first on this. This is nine any.
Yep.
You can cast this show any way that you possibly, I mean, the combinations of looks, the combinations of character pairings and all of that is just almost endless. So it's nine factorial. Anyway, what made you make that decision? And talk a little bit about Hui Haas. Here you go. Right before, day before opening night.
Okay. Well, the whole casting part of it is that I kind of started this a little bit with a divine kerfuffle. I only made the characters in kerfuffle who needed to be either male or female because they were grounded in historical individuals, male or female, but everybody else, are pretty much theys. That's why it says some of the roles are any. So starting with those characters and now every play moving forward, I am only writing non-gender specific names, and I'm using no gender specific pronouns. It's all they.
You heard that first here, folks. All right, so keep following H's work. This is the first. Go ahead.
No, yeah, everybody's like Chris and Joe and any just non-specific gender names that can be played by anybody, and no gender specific pronouns, just so that if we're casting this show right now and I have 9 people and if there's one female role and one male role, and I've got not 2 funny guys, but I've got 2 hilariously funny females, why should that funny person not get a part? So I want to set it up so that anytime my plays are done, whoever the funniest people in the room are, that's who gets cast. Doesn't matter how you identify. Doesn't matter, you know, anything at all, except bring the funny. And so I didn't know what I was going to get with this one. The premise of it is came out of a headline that I saw in a 2018 article, the New York Times, about a mob enforcer, hitman showing up to the wrong witness protection house. And so that's the thing, is that they show up to this witness protection house, these 2 mob enforcers, to whack somebody. They show up to the wrong witness protection house. And then it turns out the next door neighbors, they're also in witness protection. They just happen to be next door to each other, and chaos ensues. So that's the whole premise of the show. And it's a ton of fun. But I just wanted that to be a thing. And so how it ended up is there's 2 couples, and one of the couples has a child, and the way it ended up, I do have a male and female who have a female child, but it's never said, it's never stated. It's just, we're the couple, we're married, and we have this kid. And then the couple next door could have been male or female, or it could have been 2 males, or it could have been 2 females. And it just ended up, I ended up with 2 females. So the next door neighbors who are married, their name are Chris and Steph, and they just love each other, and they're from Minnesota, don't you know? And so, I've got 2 Minnesotan lesbians next door. And next time it might be 2 Minnesotan gay men. Who knows? I don't know. Just bring the funny. And I plan on doing that for all of my plays moving forward. I mean, it makes more opportunities for people who are in the room trying to get parts, and it makes it easier on the people who are trying to cast. On the selfish side, I think it'll make me a little more marketable in some ways. It's like, oh, I can pick this play because I can use whoever I got.
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting about that is it certainly will keep the play. You can, as an audience member, you know, if you, once the title catches on, it almost endlessly, you can almost endlessly go back to the theater and catch it at a completely different place and have a completely different visual palette that you're looking at. So the play is completely different, you know, and using the same text. And I think it's brilliant. How did the title come about? I'm going to ask you about the title. Because you put it as an unnecessarily long titled New Farce by H. Russ Brown. So it's a long one.
So. Well, the hoo-ee-haws and foo-frahs, the hoo-ee-haws, I used to live in Wisconsin, which is Minnesota adjacent. They kind of all sound the same up there to me. And we had this secretary at my kid's school. We were talking about a field day that they were having at my kid's school one day, and we had just moved to Wisconsin, so I didn't know any of the local colloquialisms or anything like that. And I was saying, wow, that's a pretty big deal out there. I didn't realize it was going to be such a large event. She goes, oh, yeah, it's just a big old hoo-ee-ha, don't you know? And I went, wow, that I am using that. I wrote that down in my little idea book and said, someday that's going in a play. So one of the next door neighbors in the show comments on the events unfolding, going, oh, such a hoo-ee-ha. And then the foo-frah is like kerfuffle or brouhaha, or, you know, just a chaos. So, you know, big events and chaos. And then the other little pieces are pieces and parcels of things that unfold in the play. A button man is another name for a mob enforcer or a mafia assassin. They call them button men sometimes. And the complete, it's misspelled, but not, C-O-M-P-L-E-A-T, which is an archaic British spelling of it. But one of the mob enforcers, because he thinks it's cool, tries to pass himself off as British for the whole first act. And then partway in the beginning of the second act, he gets caught and then he just drops his accent altogether because they busted him on it because darn it. And so he just loses it. So, but he tries to be as British as possible. And so he throws that spelling of complete in there to be all Britishy in their face at one point. And then Picket Fence, you know, it's a suburban ideal, you know, and Party Planner, one of them, not the mafia, but the New Jersey stereotype mom, she's into Martha Stewart, everything Martha Stewart. Oh, Martha. And so she's got this Party Planner book she's created that's got Martha Stewart all over it and everything. So it's all an amalgam. It's a puzzle.
All right.
Pieces of the puzzle.
All right, everyone. Well, Hooey Haas and Foo for Oz, the complete Button Man's Picket Fence Party Planner, will be releasing on May the 1st through Next Stage Press. You can pre-order it right now. The scripts will probably be shipping here in about, if you pre-order it, it'll be shipping here in about the next week and a half, and you can get it. And again, if you're down in the Houston Galveston area, or you know, anywhere that you can get there in a reasonable amount of time, you should catch this world premiere at College of the Mainland. All right, we are we're almost out of time here. I want to ask you two more things. Are you working on something else that you want to tell us about?
Yeah, I'm working on one that will be published through you guys next February. And we'll be producing it on stage here in October, November. It's called Funny Boned, or How I Learned to Shtick the Landing. It's about a vaudeville ghost and a little bit of a murder mystery about how he came to be a ghost, but it's a farce.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to that. And if people want to follow you and your writing, how is the best way for them to do that?
They can either follow Calm Theater or they can look at my personal website, hrussbrown.com. And I've got info on there and links to Next Stage Press and all that. So that's how you can follow me. But I'm going to keep cranking them out. I got ideas for days.
All right. Well, H, this has been fascinating. And again, thank you for taking time out of your, out of your school day there. You know, you're in the middle of the working it out and you jumped into the office in a little bit of time to take a few minutes with us. And I really appreciate that. We here at Next Stage Press, we are very huge fans of your work. Your work is very funny. And if you want to look for just great comedies and stuff, you can just go to the Next Stage Press website and do it in the search bar. Just type in H. Russ Brown and all four of the shows will pop up. And later on in the year, Funny Bone will pop up as well. That's all the time that we have for now. And I will be... trying to get down there and see another show, H, next time that I'm in the Houston area.
Please do. We'd love to have you.
All right. Goodbye, everybody. That does it for this episode of the Next Stage Press podcast. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please leave us a star rating and a review and let us know what Next Stage Press playwright you'd want to hear from next. Also, feel free to share our show to your theater friends and colleagues. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Shopify, Podomatic, or wherever you get your podcasts, and they are always free to listen to. Also, you can find all of our plays on our website at www.nextstagepress.com, where the first half of our plays are free to read, and licensing info is available there as well. Stay well until next time, and we wish you good health, happiness, and great theater. Goodbye, everyone.